Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York State budget deadline will be pushed back to next week as negotiations over housing and education are ongoing, Governor Hochul said yesterday. The New York lawmakers are still pushing to expand travel access to those with disabilities. We'll talk with Deborah Warden from Action Toward Independence. And New York State Legislature has already voted to ban carbon monoxide fracking, closing a decade-old loophole in the state law, one of several climate change bills. We'll find out more from Albany. NACL in Highland Lake is hosting Transforma Theater. Participants have an opportunity to interact with GPT-4 via an avatar. We'll learn more about media and tech literacy, plus collage artist Charles Wilkin, weaver Charles Hadley Blanchard, and the Wayne County Sheriff's new canine. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Investigators are still on the scene of the interstate bridge collapse in Baltimore. Tons of debris remain in the water outside the port of Baltimore. No vessels can enter or leave the port, snarling shipping traffic. Divers have found two victims' bodies underwater. Four people remain missing from the disaster and are presumed dead. Gustavo Torres is the executive director of the Maryland immigrant advocacy organization, CASA. He says two members of his organization, Miguel Luna and Maynard Suazo Sandoval, are among the missing victims. Torres says the CASA organization began to work with the men's families after the bridge collapsed.
We immediately started to reach out, and in fact we identified initially Miguel and then Maynard, who were not part of the family anymore. So unfortunately, they disappear, and still we don't know about their bodies.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. The Biden administration has approved major changes to the government's statistics about race and ethnicity used to redraw voting maps and enforce civil rights protections. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports, future census forms and federal surveys are now set to include a new checkbox for Middle Eastern or North African.
The White House's Office of Management and Budget's decision includes changing the federal government's definition of white. It will no longer include people who identify with groups such as Egyptian, Iranian, Iraqi, Israeli, Kurdish, Lebanese, Moroccan, Palestinian, Syrian, and Yemeni. That change sets up Middle Eastern or North African as the U.S. government's first completely new racial or ethnic category since officials first issued in 1977 standards on racial and ethnic data that the Census Bureau and other federal agencies must follow. Advocates for Arab Americans and other MENA groups have long campaigned for their own checkbox. Research suggests many people of MENA descent do not see themselves as white. These changes were first proposed during the Obama administration before they were shelved by Trump administration officials. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported somewhat stronger economic growth at the end of last year. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 30 points in early trading.
Revised figures show the U.S. economy grew at an annual pace of 3.4% in October, November, and December. The Commerce Department initially reported a 3.3% growth rate for the quarter. That was revised down last month to 3.2%, but now we're back up again. The latest revision shows stronger consumer spending and business investment. Whatever the number after the decimal point, it's pretty strong economic growth. The job market's also holding steady. New claims for unemployment benefits showed little change last week. Home Depot wants to do more business with professional contractors. It's buying a supply company, SRS Distribution, in a deal valued at more than $18 billion. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The government of Ireland says it is seeking to intervene in the case involving Israel before the International Court of Justice. South Africa originally launched the case accusing Israel of committing genocide against Palestinians. Irish officials say the court will decide that question, but they say Hamas's attack and taking of hostages and the Israeli military attacks on Gaza violate international humanitarian law. Sales of vinyl records went up last year as part of an ongoing trend. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, old-fashioned physical records were just one sign of growth in what turned out to be a strong year for the music industry.
Streaming remains the biggest driver of growth. Revenues from paid subscriptions topped $11 billion in 2023. But according to a new report from the Recording Industry Association of America, sales of vinyl records shot up 10% from the year before. Thank Taylor Swift for many of those sales. Her vinyl version of this album sold more than a million copies soon after its release last October. But vinyl has been on the rise for nearly 20 years. Overall, sales of recorded music grew by 8% over the previous year, which was the eighth year in a row that music sales have increased. Nado Ulibi, NPR News.
Nobody won the Powerball lottery jackpot last night. The drawing on Saturday night will be for a jackpot worth $935 million. Earlier this week, one ticket matched the Mega Millions Lotto jackpot. That was worth more than $1 billion. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York State's budget deadline will be pushed back to next week as negotiations over housing and education are ongoing, Governor Kathy Hochul said last night. Hochul said in a statement she would deliver a bill to lawmakers delaying the budget's due date until April 4th. Budget negotiations conducted in private between the Democratic leaders of the Senate and Assembly and Hochul, also a Democrat, were expected to drag out beyond the original April 1st deadline, which is Monday, right after Easter, though officials have indicated that the meetings have been productive. According to the Associated Press, lawmakers appear cautious to avoid the kind of blow-up that delayed last year's spending plan by more than a month as Democrats fought over bail laws and a plan to spur housing construction. Still, familiar subjects have emerged as sticking points this year. Lawmakers are trying to forge a deal on a housing plan that includes new construction, tenant protections, and a tax break for developers to incentivize building in the state that's notorious for high rents and home costs. One bill that's already on the governor's desk would extend the state's ban on natural gas fracking after the state legislature acted recently to close a decades-long loophole in state law and prohibit using liquid carbon dioxide to extract the gas from shale rock. The vote is a new win for the state's anti-fracking movement, which sees the process as a way to skirt a ban it pushed through 10 years ago and heads off a Texas-based company that says it would produce net zero natural gas and sequester carbon dioxide. It's one of several measures that lawmakers are considering to combat climate change. From the New York Public News Network, Karen DeWitt reports.
New York banned the hydrofracking of natural gas in 2014. Since then, a new type of fracking has been pioneered in China. It uses liquefied carbon dioxide to extract the gas from shale rock. Many environmentalists say the process can potentially cause earthquakes and acidify drinking water. Senate Leader Andrea Stort-Cousins says she wants to make sure it's not used in New York.
This is not just a policy decision, but it's a moral decision to protect the lives of our constituents in their communities.
Senator Leah Webb represents parts of the Southern Tier, including Binghamton, where the underground shale rock contains untapped natural gas. She says over 6,000 landowners in her district have received land leasing offers from fracking companies wanting to use the liquefied CO2 to extract the gas.
If we don't close this loophole sooner rather than later, it is going to essentially open up a proverbial gateway for further exploration, which is also going to be problematic.
Both houses passed the bill earlier this month. It next goes to Governor Hochul. Senate Leader Stort-Cousins says she doesn't know if the governor is on board with the fracking ban extension because the two have not discussed the issue.
It is my hope that she is.
A spokesman for Hochul says the legislation has not yet been sent, but when it does, the governor will review it. The bill is one of several in the 2024 legislative session that addresses climate change. A measure known as the New York Heat Act would eliminate a policy that allows gas companies to charge ratepayers for the cost of installing new gas lines if they are within 100 feet of a home or business. The Senate approved the legislation, and Hochul included it in her budget plan. In addition, the Hochul administration is implementing the Climate Change Act. It aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to zero by 2040. It also bans natural gas hookups at newly constructed buildings beginning in 2026. Senate Republican leader Robert Ort, whose party is in the minority in the legislature, disagrees with those measures. He says they'll result in the loss of good-paying jobs in New York's energy industry and higher prices.
Bottom line is the people who put down our infrastructure, they are going to be harmed. The people who pay for that infrastructure are going to be harmed. Our ratepayers are going to be harmed at a time when all we hear about is affordability.
Ort spoke at a news conference on the Capitol's Grand Central Staircase. One floor above him, anti-climate change advocates were rallying. Senator Jessica Ramos, a progressive Democrat, addressed that rally. She says some residents in her East Elmhurst district in Queens drowned when unprecedented rainfall during Hurricane Ida, which is believed to be connected to climate change, flooded their basement apartments. She says she'll be pushing to make sure the state stays on track in its goals to reduce emissions.
And we cannot wait! We cannot wait any longer! I will not wait for another one of my neighbors to drown!
In addition to the other measures, Senator Ramos backs the Climate Change Superfund Act. It would require big oil companies to pay for damages caused by climate change. She says it could net $3 billion to the state to fund efforts to reduce greenhouse gases.
This is how we want to use our taxpayer dollars, that this is how we want these companies to pay so that we have the funding to put shovels in the ground and update our infrastructure as our health outcomes require.
The Climate Superfund Act is included in the Senate's budget proposal. The Assembly didn't add it to their plan, but they included language saying that they support the concept. The measure is opposed by the major oil companies. They say it would be a retroactive tax. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
This is Radio Chatskill. New York lawmakers are still pushing to expand travel access for those with disabilities. Most people can easily navigate public spaces. However, those with disabilities lack of adult changing tables and similar accommodations turns these simple activities into major challenges. That could change in New York with new legislation called the Traveling with Dignity Act. Joining us now with more is Deborah Warden, Executive Director of Action Toward Independence. ATI is focused on just this type of accessibility and independence. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much for having me. It's always such an honor and pleasure to be here on WJFF.
Thank you for being here. Thanks for telling us about this Traveling with Dignity Act. What will that do for folks with disabilities in public spaces?
Absolutely. So what it is, it's basically requiring adult changing stations to be installed in public spaces, and that could be museums, national parks, rest areas, anywhere that people are having access, because over 250,000 people utilize a wheelchair in New York State. And it is really hard to be able to go, you know, our state is very large. So a person with a disability and they're having to wear an adult brief, for example, and they have an incontinency disability or possibly paralysis or something like that, they're required to be changed every 2 hours. And you and I both know just to travel to Albany, that's over a 2 hour ride. And there's no adult changing station on the thruway to get to Albany, for example. So this would require those entities to install those adult changing tables. And it's really important to understand it's not just a table. It is an electronic device that allows it to raise or lower depending upon the accessibility of the person utilizing a wheelchair. And it also gives the caregivers that opportunity to be sure to take care of their loved one with dignity. And that's really what so much of accessibility is about.
I think most of us are familiar with the baby changing tables in
Yes.
most public spaces, restrooms and things like that. An adult changing table is maybe something that's not familiar to many people. And explain a little bit more. You've explained mm-hmm. a little bit about that, but why is that so important to have for folks with a disability?
Absolutely. So one of the hardest things is transferring out of the wheelchair. So to transfer, you're usually hopefully having at the same height and space of your chair and have it right up a joint so that you can easily transfer onto a table. And a lot of times transferring is happening because the caregiver is lifting that person. So it's not necessarily even something that the person themselves can do, you know, so they have to be assisted even to transfer to a table. So having a table that is able to be raised up and down, and really even we're advocating for doctor's offices, for example, if you go, it's just very similar to an exam table where you go in and take an exam. Imagine we all just walk into a doctor's office and they're like, okay, hop up on the table. Mm-hmm. That's not possible for everyone. Right. So even our physicians need to be cognizant of having accessible tables for people to utilize.
You know, the Americans with Disability Act helped change some of these things and for accessibility. You know, most prominent, I think, for most folks in seeing it visibly in a public restroom, like there's always that ADA compliant part of the bathroom. Mm-hmm. But this is a step further. And do you think that then it becomes more commonplace and not, I don't know, acceptable, but understandable? Why is it taking so long?
Yeah, you know? That's a really good question. Well, the same could be said about the ADA. Only been around since 1990. Where most of us think about civil rights is in the 60s, where really we're kind of even still way behind the curve on that. So I think that it's just, you know, having more people be aware that individuals with disabilities are entitled to the same access. They want to enjoy museums. They want to be able to travel. They want to be able to go, and their caregivers as well. And to just be able to have that ability to do it is so wonderful for our society in general, you know. And also another thing, you see a lot of ramps, you know, there oftentimes years ago, it was only steps to the post office, for example, where now every federal building has a ramp. And so to make those accommodations, you know, so for example, if an entity is doing over $10,000 worth of construction, that is the threshold that they're required to also incorporate construction of the new bathroom. So there's different points to the bill. And also I'm hopeful and, you know, pretty confident that there's going to be some grants available, especially for nonprofits to be able to make those modifications, because a table does cost between $8,000 to $10,000.
This bill would help increase accessibility in public spaces. What types of public spaces are we talking about, and what kinds of spaces are we not talking about? Do you think this bill goes far enough?
That's a really good question, and we'll have to see, because a big thing about is reasonable accommodations. You know, obviously, if it's like some very historic building, is it possible for that accommodation to be made? It has to, you know, we kind of look at the big picture where we are cognizant of that. But it's really about, I think, making people very well aware. And also, you made a great point, Tim, like we're so used to now seeing the accessible bathrooms. We walk into a bathroom and you see the handlebars, you see a specific stall for accessibility. And I think it's really important for people to, you know, be aware. And also, if you don't have a disability, not to use that stall and not to, you know, utilize that space. And so it's just giving us more opportunity for people to travel. And another point of travel with dignity, which I hope to see at some point in time, is really a lot of changes with the airlines. The number of wheelchairs and adaptable equipment that is damaged is astronomical and really shameful. So we're really hoping and advocating for airlines to also step up their travel with dignity as well.
And we mentioned, you know, we're talking about the adult changing tables. Are there other accommodations that are included or considered in this bill? Things you'd like to see?
Yeah, it is mainly for the adult changing tables for this particular legislation. And also, just to be clear, New York is not unique in this. There's already several states that have this already. Arizona, California, Michigan, Pennsylvania. They've already passed similar laws. So thankfully, we're, you know, really in the forerunners with those who have been participating in this type of legislation, and we can set a great example.
What happens next? It's a bipartisan bill. We mentioned that the budget is still being negotiated and pushed back now until next week on the 4th. Is this part of that process, or is it separate of that process? What's happening?
So right now it's in the Senate Finance Committee, and they're hoping that everything will be passed by 2025 with implementation in 2032. So that's, you know, I always say, even to our staff, when we kind of get frustrated that change doesn't happen fast enough, that, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, but it was still built. And, you know, that's kind of how we look at disability, right? You know, we're going to make this happen. We just have to bring awareness and attention to it on a regular basis.
What are you working on now in terms of awareness and other things that you're working on?
Oh, my goodness.
To build Rome.
Yeah, right. There's so much going on in Sullivan County, and I'm so proud of our team. Like, I can't even begin to express how amazing the staff are at ATI. We're working a lot with veterans. You know, we have the Vet to Vet program. and our veteran peer advocates are doing a lot in focusing on arts and recovery, you know, how to utilize music therapy, journal writing, or, you know, other types of things that aren't necessarily offered by the VA, you know, so this way we're able to have an eclectic group of activities that are happening. And we also got an amazing donation from Delaware Valley Farm and Garden in Calicoon. They gave us outerwear and boots that, so if there's any veteran out there who's interested in getting some wonderful clothing, please contact our office because this is free to you. You have given so much to us. And yeah, I just love the opportunity that we're able to serve them. And then we're working diligently with Commissioner Little on the housing crisis in Sullivan County. That really has a huge impact on our clients with disabilities. But on the plus side, you know, no matter how we kind of look at things and like, oh gosh, all this is happening. On the plus side is the fact that our county health rankings changed drastically. Yep. So I am super happy about that because I was even when we've been working on this for so long, I'm like, I'm just hoping we get to 59, you know, like get out of the 60s. And now we're 57. So I feel like, okay, the work that we're doing, it is building that room. You know, we're getting there.
Dan, who was from here from Sullivan County Government last Friday, as he is every Friday, and we talked about that, 57 out of the 62 yeah. counties where we had traditionally been around 61, 60, yeah. sometimes 62. Yeah. And this is also data that is the most recent data,
correct,
which is a couple of years old. So it's nice to hear that what everybody is working together collectively on in the county to mm-hmm. do this is actually having some impact. And let's see how much further up we can go.
Yeah.
And it's good to know and remind folks that Action Toward Independence is part of that cohort of individuals in the county trying to push that
yeah,
forward.
Yeah, absolutely. It's our honor and privilege to serve our people here and, you know, to help any person with a disability and their caregiver. Just like we help any veteran, we also help their family members, too. So we're really fortunate to be able to have that ability to be so inclusive of everyone trying to help everybody.
So speaking of help, what do you want folks to know in terms of like how they can help Action Toward Independence and get involved?
Well, I would love for anyone to check out our website, which is atitoday.org. You can also check out our Facebook page, which is very active, and you can call us at 845-794-4228. You can always make a donation directly to our organization. We'd be so grateful. And any little bit helps, or any, even if you wanted to donate food, hygiene products, anything like that, that we're able to give out to our clients who are really struggling. Just give us a call and we can see what we can do to get your help.
And if folks wanted to learn more about the Traveling with Dignity Act that we've been talking about too, and how they could write to their local officials about their support, they could reach out to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can connect you with our local supporters of this as well. And again, it's about advocacy. We really just want attention brought to enable people to be able to travel. And any individual with a disability is entitled to do that.
You know, you mentioned that this may not get passed for a little bit. Rome wasn't built in a day. But are you hopeful that it's heading in the right direction?
I am. I really am. Because I think that, you know, people are recognizing that it also has an impact on commerce as well. Imagine how many more people are able to come out and participate in a ball game or go to a museum or, you know, have a picnic at a park. There's a lot more, you know, while this is an initial investment for those entities, imagine how many more people are going to be able to come out and participate in things that you would not normally have had them involved with.
It's an issue of independence. It's an issue of dignity, but also an issue of equality.
Very much so. That is absolutely right. And it is about having the ability to, you know, participate in things that everybody else does. And especially like a ball game. Imagine what it would be like to go just to a ball game and not have to worry, I can only stay here for an hour, even if it took you an hour to get there, less than, you know, if you're lucky. But if you're thinking in your mind, I can't stay here long because of my disability, you know, why even go? So this would give someone that opportunity and that window. And that, I think, is priceless.
Deborah Warden, Executive Director of Action Toward Independence. Thank you so much for being here. You're always a bright light in the studio.
Thank you
so much. And can I just share with folks that I learned some trivia, some Sullivan County trivia
yes.
today? I told you when you came in. I passed this Warden Lane. It's spelled the same way as your last name. And you told me that's your, like, family's road.
Yeah. And that used to be Old Route 52, actually. That was the original Route 52. Yeah.
We need to change our address. 2758 Warden Lane. That should be the Radio Catskill studio address. Deb Warden, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll learn more about the new member of the Wayne County Sheriff's Department, a canine. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Wayne County Sheriff's Department welcomed a new canine to the office in mid-January, and the young shepherd is currently in training. Once fully trained and certified, she will be providing drug detection and search and rescue services, among other services. In recent weeks, she and her handler, Chief Deputy Deneen Van Horn, have been out meeting the community and helping to raise money for the Wayne County Community Foundation Fund, created to care for Onyx and her maintenance. They've got a fundraiser this Saturday, and here to tell us more is Chief Deputy Van Horn from Wayne County Sheriff's Department. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us more about this shepherd, Onyx. Where did she come from, and where is she being trained?
So I picked up Onyx in January from Mountaineer Canine Services, located in West Virginia, and we will be training with a local trainer, and his name is Alan Finn.
Yeah, I have a puppy. She's two, but she's still a puppy. And I know a lot of training that goes into my puppy. I imagine there's a little bit more that goes into training for a canine for service in law enforcement. Can you tell folks about some of the process that involved in training a dog to be part of the sheriff's department?
Okay, yeah. So I'm a new handler, so this is kind of all new to me as well. So we're training together. We're pretty much training right now every day from the time we get up to the time we go to bed. As you know, puppies, you know, need a lot of attention and care. So we're currently working on a lot of obedience training to build her that strong foundation. And also part of her training is to be well socialized. So we've been visiting, you know, some of the local schools to meet the children, just to kind of get Onyx out there in the community. And we're also have done some kind of meet and greets just, you know, to get the word out that we now have a new dog. We have started doing some narcotic detection training, which Onyx really loves doing and she enjoys it. Once we get a little bit further on with that, we'll start to transition into the tracking and apprehension portion.
Now, you said you're also a new handler. When you found out that you were going to be a handler, what did you think, having not really done this before?
Very excited. It's something I've always kind of, you know, thought about doing. And, of course, I'm a dog lover. I didn't realize how much actually goes into it, but I'm so grateful that I have the opportunity to do this with Onyx and we get to learn together.
Is Onyx the only canine in the department?
Yes, she is. We did have canine Manfred, and he retired last year.
Oh, well, good for Manfred, enjoying a retirement.
Yes, absolutely.
When will Onyx be available to other agencies, and once she's fully trained, how long does that take? And she's actually sworn in, right? There's a ceremony.
There will be. She is not sworn in yet.
Yeah.
But we will be having a ceremony at some point. So since we're just kind of in the beginning stages, we're not sure exactly when we'll be certified. But once we are certified, we'll be available for other law enforcement agencies, you know, anything they might need from us.
So how does that work? They would reach out to you once she's trained and sworn in. They would reach out saying, hey, we need this type of assistance.
Yes, probably through our communication center. If they happen to be, let's just say, in a traffic stop and they needed the canine, they would just reach out to us and we would show up and help.
It's like a law enforcement play date.
Absolutely.
So tell me a little bit about the community interaction. You mentioned going out into the community, helping raise money for the Wayne County Community Foundation Fund and the interaction with folks. How do folks react to Onyx?
she is a hit. Everybody absolutely loves her. She's great with children, which is why it's been good to for us to reach out to the schools. We're also this Saturday going to the Easter egg hunt at Bingham Park. It's Saturday at 11 a.m. We're going to have a table set up there to sell some T-shirts, bandanas, stickers. People get to meet Onyx. We're also going to be doing, if people want to have their photo taken for Onyx. And all of that money does go directly towards Onyx through the Wayne County Community Foundation, and they help provide for her care and training.
So this money that's raised at the Easter egg hunt, Holly, and other mm-hmm. efforts is all for, goes right to Onyx?
It does, yes. Oh, absolutely, wow. Every penny.
That's great. And then, so tell us a little bit about Onyx's personality. You know, I imagine being a member of the Sheriff's Department, she's rather serious, but is she also kind of playful?
She is. It's funny how she just kind of knows when she's at work and when she's at home. She's totally a different dog. She's goofy, silly, you know, and where she is still a puppy, she's only 9 months, she's still a little, you know, clumsy and klutzy when she's like running around chasing a ball or something. But she loves running around with my other dogs. She's very smart. She's eager to learn. She's a great dog.
And we mentioned
we got a really good one.
Yeah, and we mentioned these, you know, the services she provides, drug detection, search and rescue. What are some of the other services? What are some of the other things that she's being trained to do to help the Sheriff's Department?
So pretty much it's going to be the drug detection is going to be a big one. And also the tracking, if someone were lost, you know, they can reach out to us, whether it's a child, maybe an elderly person, and we can try to help locate them. And then apprehension, if it's needed again, hopefully not too much in this area, but we'll have her if she's needed.
And you mentioned the previous canine. I'm sorry, is it Manfred? Is that mm-hmm.
Yes, correct.
Right. Manfred. How long how long does a canine stay in service usually for the Sheriff's Department? What's a typical range that, you know, Onyx will be there?
Well, where she's 9 months, my understanding, again, I'm a new handler. As long as the dog stays healthy and there aren't any issues, they could be in service up to, I believe, like 7 or 8 years. It really all depends on the canine, and we just kind of take it year by year. We go to our vet regularly to make sure she's in the best shape she can be in, and that if she needs anything, we make sure we get it for her.
And you mentioned the Easter egg hunt that's Saturday in Holly. There are other visits and demonstrations you do. Do you accept like requests for people that might want to have Onyx come visit, like a school or another nonprofit mm-hmm. or something like that?
I actually have gotten quite a lot of requests from some schools. But if you wanted to request a visit from Onyx or a demonstration when we get to that training portion of it, you can reach out to myself at the Wayne County Sheriff's Office. Or you could also go to Wayne County Sheriff's Canine Onyx, which is Onyx's Facebook page. You can reach out there, and we would love if you would check out her page and like it and follow us.
Onyx has her own Facebook page, of course.
She does, indeed.
That's great. All right, so we can get more information there. And again, let's remind folks about Saturday if they wanted to come by and see Onyx.
Yes, so we're going to be at the Easter egg hunt at Bingham Park in Holly. And it starts at 11 a.m. sharp, I hear. And it sounds like it's a great event. This will, you know, obviously be our first year attending it, but I've heard it's an excellent event and the kids love it. So we're looking forward to seeing everybody out there.
All right. That's Chief Deputy Deneen Van Horn from the Wayne County Sheriff's Department letting us know about Onyx, the new canine in the office who's currently in training and is currently an influencer on social media. Thank you so much for talking to us today. And tell Onyx hello. Give her a pet for us.
I sure will. And thank you so much.
All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back, two artists to talk to our culture reporter, Valerie Manzi, about a talk tonight at the Derby. We'll hear from the two Charleses right after this. This is Radio Chatsco.
Hey, this is DJ Chucks of Old School Sessions. Please join me and Selector Starkey at our new time, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Saturday night.
Old school, baby. Old school, baby. Old school, baby.
That's Old School Sessions right here on WJFF, 8 to midnight, Saturday night, only on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week we are baking pies, breads, cakes, and a little something you're not going to want to miss called a self-saucing pudding. We're talking to one of the buzziest pastry chefs in New York, a beloved Mexican food blogger, and a scene-stealing contestant from The Great British Baking Show. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tonight, collage artist Charles Wilkin and weaver Charles Hadley Blanchard will have an artist talk at the Darby Hotel from 6 to 8 in Beach Lake, Pennsylvania. It's part of the textile show Color, Thread, Cloth, which is on now. And our culture reporter, Valerie Manzi, spoke to the two Charleses. First, Charles Wilkin.
Good morning, Charles, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Val. How are you?
I am wonderful, and I love your shirt that you have on today.
So this is
it's
my
kind this, of fun but creepy.
Well, this is my fancy sweater. It's Gossamer from Bugs Bunny.
Oh, okay. You know well, Bugs Bunny could be a little scary.
Well, this is my favorite character because it kind of works out with my hair because it's one where he's like, you know, an interesting monster and he's an interesting hairdo.
Yes.
So that's the one.
And for those of you who know Charles, you know about his interesting hairdos.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And if you don't know him, well, you're in for a treat. Okay. And he's given me some pointers on hairstyling.
Yes.
Over the years.
I'm bringing hairspray back.
Okay, Charles. So you're here to talk about an artist talk.
Yes.
That you will be participating in at the Darby.
Yes.
And it's co-sponsored with Somewhere Company. And you'll be joined by Charles Blanchard, who I will interview later as well. Tell us about your work and what brought you to that particular series.
So this is a really great group show. It's a fabric show, you know, of a bunch of different local artists. And it's all scattered about the hallways there at the Darby Hotel, which is a great space for showing artwork.
And a beautiful space.
Oh, yeah. It's great. They've done a great job redoing it. And Avi, the new owner, is really, you know, interested in promoting local artists and all this stuff. So it's a really good combination. And then my dear friends Randall and Judy, who have Somewhere Co., curated the show, and they did an incredible job putting it all together.
Have you always worked in fabric?
I have not. This is like a new project for me. I'm most well known for my paper collages, which is sort of layering paper on vintage photographs that I find in magazines and books or whatever. I would say for about the last 10 years, I've been clipping what I call fabric scraps out of modern magazines like Vogue and Harper's Bazaar and things like that. So, you know, taking the fashion shoots from those magazines and cutting the fabric up and then layering it on top of the image. Over the years, my work has just become synonymous with like those sort of fabric scraps, paper scraps from. And I would say, you know, I did a show last year at Cass up in Livingston Manor. With that show, I was sort of launching this new direction that I'm doing where I've actually started working with real fabric and creating more dimensional work, more sculptural-based stuff, and integrating imagery and all kinds of things. You know, I do everything from like just gluing it down to stitching it to reweaving it and integrating it into the photographs in interesting ways, or just making straight-up sculpture, you know, just making forms. You know, my work has always been kind of figurative and a little bit of portraiture. I like to consider my work very surreal. So all the pieces I make are very...
I saw them. They are definitely surreal. The colors and textures.
I love color. I mean, I love color so much. And I think the thing about having done paper collage for 20 years, I love that medium, but I just felt like I had kind of exhausted where I was going with that. And so using real fabric and creating these more dimensional pieces felt like a really good segue. My current theme is making surrealism real, at least for me anyway. So trying to bring these pieces into the real world and trying to create things that people can interact with more in a tactile way in the dimensions and things like that. they seem tactile, and they have lots of dimension. For the cast show, I made really dimensional sculptural work.
And for this?
And for this, because it's a hallway, the pieces hang on the wall, so they're not as dimensional as the sculpture things that I did for at CAS.
And what is your website so folks can
sure.
see your work, because you have quite a body of work?
Yes. I mean, I've been at it, you know, since 1988.
Wow.
So my website is just charleswilkin.com, and you can check out my Instagram. It's just charles_wilkin on Instagram. That's actually a better place to check out what's happening. I'm very slow at updating my website.
Okay. The work is a lot of fun to look at, in some cases quite curious.
Yes.
And quite startling.
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes everywhere from
scary
to really beautiful.
Absolutely. And in one piece.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the things that struck me at CAS was it was scary, but it was also beautiful.
Yes.
And was a little freaky, but it kind of was, well, you know, this is life, beautiful, and it's scary, and it can be a little freaky.
Well, and I think that's an incredible thing for you to say, because that's exactly sort of how I do it. It's, you know, I sort of consider myself like a sponge. So I sort of take it all in. I look around at everything going around and think about it and, you know, sort of distill it, and then I push it back out through my work. And so sometimes, you know, it can be very scary. Sometimes it can be very beautiful. Sometimes it can just be optimistic in that we could make this world a better place. My work is definitely not political. It's not trying to make any statements. It's not, I think really what it is I'm just always trying to distill it down to what are these emotions that we all experience and maybe, you know, don't understand or don't know how to vocalize or talk about. You know, I use instinct in my work a lot, and I think that is really where it comes from. My process is wildly spontaneous. I often say I don't know where I'm going till I get there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, too, this is why there's a lot of variety in there. I know a piece is done when all the chaos of making just turns into like this really quiet, calm, it's very peaceful moment where I just know that it's like done.
And do you feel at peace after it?
I do, because it takes so much energy to make it, you know, not necessarily physically. You know, I'm not like moving huge boulders to make a sculpture.
Right.
but you know, emotionally, just getting in the zone, and there's a lot of searching. I call it the perceptive reading of paper scraps. It's a lot of fishing around, looking, because I have piles of scraps on my desk, and just trying to find the right fit. I would say with this newer work, working with actual fabric and building sculpture, it definitely is more physical. This is all new to me. I never studied to be a sculptor. So there's a huge learning curve here for me.
Thanks.
So exciting. I feel like with paper, I knew what to do. It was kind of inherent.
Yeah.
Now often I find like I'll build something and I'll be like, well, that needed a structure. And now I have to work backwards because I don't know. I didn't know what kind of structure to make when I got started. So it's a little annoying at the same time. But
yeah, but you work it through when you do it.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. How about giving our listeners some information about the event?
Sure. So it's at the Darby Hotel, which is just on the other side of the Narrowsburg Bridge there. And the talk is this Thursday, the 28th. And I will be talking with Charles Hadley Blanchard.
Yes.
And it is from 6 to 8. They have the bar opened there. I think it's called the Delphine there. So you can have a little cocktail, and then we'll hang out. And Randall and Judy will be there with some great questions. And we'll just chat about the work and all the other good things that go along with that.
Okay. Well, I was at the last one, and it was fun.
Yeah, it was great.
So
yeah.
It was fun. Well, thank you, Charles, for coming in, and have fun tomorrow night.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And speaking of the other Charles, Weaver Charles Hadley Blanchard is the other artist that Charles Wilkin mentioned, and he also spoke to culture reporter Valerie Manzi.
So today I interviewed the two Charleses, and the two Charleses, Charles Wilkin and Charles Blanchard, will both be speaking at the Derby tomorrow night, Thursday the 28th, from 6 to 8. They will be giving an artist talk as part of the Color of Thread exhibit. So, yeah. Charles, tell us about the work that you're showing there.
Oh, well, I weave, and I weave all the time, every day. And the pieces that were chosen to be put there are eclectic, to say the least. But then all my work is sort of, I'm not coming from a tradition, so I'm just able to design and weave whatever I want within physical parameters, width and length.
And are your creations functional?
Well, as a wall hanging, for sure.
Yes.
The ones that are there, I think one of them was over a bench in the studio.
Uh-huh.
Table runners. There's all sorts of uses. The larger pieces that I weave can work on the floor, but I find that most people are reluctant to do that. They want to display them on the wall.
Yeah.
So I've been weaving smaller pieces like table runners and wall hangings.
And you have a store in Narrowsburg, correct?
Yes, 101 Main Street.
And that's called?
Dyeberry Weaver.
Dyeberry Weaver, that's it. And yeah. Do you have a website as well?
I think so. I'm not really active on it.
Okay. Instagram?
There is. And I think there might be, but I have no idea how to do it. So.
Oh, okay. Okay. So we'll have to go to Narrowsburg to check it out.
Yeah, pretty much.
When did you start weaving?
Would have been 1968.
Wow. And what brought you to it?
My girlfriend was a potter. She showed me how to set up a little hand loom, a little table loom. I immediately identified with something in it, so I started doing it. And then I received a big floor loom in 1970. I've been weaving ever since.
Where do you source your materials?
Oh, I used to get them from all over the place, but now the sources have really been eliminated. There's just not that much hand weaving being done. So I used to get them from various sources. I actually had a lot of alpaca fleece given to me by a local farmer, and I had that spun in Michigan into yarn, and I used that for quite a long time. Now my yarn comes from a jobber outside of New York City.
And what is that fabric?
There's two elements to weaving. There's the warp and the weft. And the warp runs through the loom, and it's controlled by my feet. The weft is that which is woven into the fabric, and that is on shuttles. So my warp is silk, and my weft is, at this time, is wool.
So that gives it an interesting texture.
You don't see the silk at all. It's all hidden in the warp, in the fabric.
Okay.
So it's just the wool that you see and feel. The silk is for strength.
Uh-huh. And how long have you had your store in Narrowsburg? That's been a while.
I opened it in March of 2003.
Wow. I didn't realize it was quite that long. My goodness. Time flies.
When you're having fun.
Your weavings probably will outlast us, I think.
There's a piece right in front of my door that's been there for 20 years or so. Look, it shows its wear. I have others in the studio that I do my meditation sitting on a piece that I wove back in 1973. So they can last.
And you still have a lot of enthusiasm and love of what you do from the way you sound.
Yeah. I used to be able to do this on the weekends.
Yes.
And in the morning before work, I had many, many jobs. I was a printer for years. Then holiday weekends were like a blessing for me because I would get to weave for 3 days without interruption.
Uh-huh.
But now I get to weave every day.
Oh, good for you. Tomorrow night, you'll be speaking with Charles Wilkin, and that will be a talk that takes place Thursday, the 28th, from 6 to 8 at the Derby. Right, Charles, thank you for taking the time to share this information with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie. Thank you.
Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to the two Charleses. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tomorrow, NACL in Highland Lake is hosting Transforma Theater, who will offer a public workshop in media and tech literacy. Participants will even have the opportunity to interact with GPT-4, I hope I got that right, via an avatar. Here to tell us what that really means is Brett Kaiser, our Director of Public Engagement at NACL, and Yasha Ferme, co-founder and artistic director of Transforma Theater. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Yasha, so did I say that correctly, and what does it mean?
You said it correctly, and what does
is
it mean?
Is this ChatGPT? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Like AI?
Yes,
okay.
AI.
So
tell us
about this AI theatrical experience that we're talking about.
So it kind of started with our previous show that's called BioAdapted that we were also working on here at NACL about a year ago. In which we kind of interwoven transcripts as well as fictional pieces about humorous and eerie examples of AI in the future. And while we were in our workshop production, a lot of people were coming to us and they were just interested in learning more about the tools, about how this is constructed. And so we said, okay, let's do this. Let's try to create a media and technology literacy workshop. You know, personally, I feel like we're so bombarded with all these AI tools and the promises that, you know, you won't need actors in Hollywood movies anymore. You won't need editors. You won't need graphic designers. So I think that we're here kind of to like debunk these myths and, you know, kind of go over this. There's so many apps. You wouldn't believe it. There's like thousands and thousands and thousands. So we're kind of doing the job for you and testing all of these apps and seeing what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, my feeling is, yeah, okay, great. Certain things work, but they're really behind huge paywalls. But it's like a Tide commercial. Do you mean, put a tomato and pour some wine on your white apron and, you know, you're going to get the shiny brand new apron. And, you know, that's not true.
Not necessarily the promise it's living up to. But I think we sort of now use this term AI as if we all know what it means. But what you're saying is maybe we don't exactly understand it, the good and the bad of it. You know, of course, AI, as you mentioned, was a bone of contention during the Hollywood strike last fall and people thinking that's going to replace jobs. So you're here to kind of just let's just see what this really is. Let's take an honest look at it.
That's our goal. And I will say there's a lot of material to go through. And, you know, we're basically in a symposium mode right now where technologists, philosophers, technical people, theater people, visual artists that have been using different AI models and molecular structures. So we're just people from different different winds trying to get a good grasp of what this is, research it and, you know, package it so that we can offer something useful to people.
How does this work as theater? It's a media and tech workshop on literacy. How does it work as theater? Transforma Theater, based in New York, a nonprofit with the mission to create interactive theater experiences, I guess the interactive part I understand.
Yeah.
What do I experience then as an audience member coming to this?
Okay. Awesome. So you're going to come in and, you know, this is a presentation. This is, let's say you're a beta tester. So this is the first time we're doing it. It's our first draft. But you will be interacting with all of these technologies yourself. Wow. You're going to be interviewing the GPT-4. We created we had an avatar, but now we built a new avatar that's based on one of our participants.
New and improved.
We have improved. And then we're going to have people try out GPT-4 for themselves. They're going to try Midjourney, which is a visual AI designer or, you know, basically a visual AI generator tool and some different video stuff. So we're going to invite volunteers from the audience to join us, quote unquote, on a hot seat. Nothing bad will happen. We have this mapped out, but we just basically want to be responsive and engage audience members so that they can test out what they're interested in.
Brett, you know, anyone who knows NACL knows that you guys love to have things that are unique, different, challenging for your audience. What do you expect them to take away from this theatrical experience and project workshop?
You know, this what Tiasha is saying here was a question that I had as well. It's like, what exactly are people going to experience here? Like, I've been excited about it, and I know, and you know, it's been described as being a playful, interactive experience. But it's not theater as such. You were saying, what's the theater part of it? It's a presentation, and it's part of my understanding of Transformers' work is that they're really interested in understanding and conveying an understanding of the science that is part of our lives in these times. And right now they happen to be focused on AI. Next week, next Friday, there is actually a work in progress presentation of their new performance, which they are creating, which Tiasha can speak to in a moment. But that's going to be a much more theatrical, like traditional theatrical experience, if I'm correct.
Well, Tiasha, I want to ask you about that. The mission statement for Transformer, it's, you know, I mentioned the interactive theater experiences at the nexus of consciousness, science, and ritual. How did you guys come to that? And why do you think it's important to have this nexus for people to understand in the theatrical
Bane. Oh my God. That's just like, that's,
do we have
that's,
enough time?
No, that's my inner life. That's my entire life's work. It's hard to explain. I think that we're in an interesting time right now. I think that, you know, science is making exponential progress. And I think that there's a need for integration of that knowledge and understanding. And I think that a really big part of being a human being is our spirituality or just self-awareness. And I think that there needs to be some kind of a connection between these two notions, if you want. And so, yeah, Transforma is dedicated to creating interactive theatrical experiences at the convergence of science, consciousness, and ritual. So it's really kind of like looking through a lens of science and then looking through a lens of maybe, you know, spiritual or occult and exploring this in the arena of interactive theater. And I feel like audience members are a huge part of why we're here and what we want to do. I'm interested in creating experiments and doing things that are unpredictable and even for our part of the team so that we can learn together and create something new together.
I think it's refreshing to hear someone from the theater world wanting to create and invent in this way and maybe, you know, not develop a jukebox musical of Nickelback songs. So thank you. Tell me about next week's performance and how this is, what that's about.
What that's about. Okay. So we're working on a sequel to BioAdapted that's called AI Hallucinations. I don't know how much people know about AI hallucinations, but they've been also called glitches. But they're kind of crazy. You know, I think that this became kind of like a quintessential piece of AI hallucinations, and the way this reached the public was a New York Times article by Kevin Roos and his transcription with Bing. Bing is Microsoft's search engine, who basically fell in love with him and tried to convince him to leave his wife and take off with him.
I remember this.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is this attracted me, and I was like, oh my God, what is this? And then I started researching it, and it turns out that there's plenty of examples of this. And Seth Lazar is also a philosopher and tech researcher who kind of like piggybacked on this story and asked Bing about this case of his interaction with Kevin, and basically Bing right away like snapped into his Sydney mode. And was like, oh, you're trying to prevent me. You're in cahoots with Kevin.
Fascinating.
It's just nuts. And yeah, so,
right for theater. I mean, amazing.
Right for theater. Right. Exactly.
We've got to get going, but Brett, tell us where we can get more information about tomorrow's event and then next week too.
Yes. So, just so everyone knows, tomorrow's event is free. We are asking that people, if you're interested in coming, to just RSVP at our website, nacl.org. And you can also get tickets for next week's show, AI Hallucinations. It's a work in progress, so it will be selections from that piece.
Brett Kaiser, NACL, and Tiasha Ferme, co-founder and artistic director of Transforma Theater. We should have you come back next week and talk about this one a little bit more in depth. That would be great. Put you on the spot. But that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. We're live human being people bringing this to you. And thank you for listening. I'm Tim Bruno.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union, and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Engineer Saad Bamla loves solving biological mysteries, like the strange way a bug in his backyard was peeing.
I was like, hey, there's something happening. There's a droplet at its butt and it's flicking it. I was like, all right. Challenge accepted, bug.
Animal enigmas. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, live, local news, culture, and NPR. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.